Luca listened in silence, a bright red cloak wrapped around him, until most of the show folks' energy was spent. When their shouts began to trickle away, he flung back the cloak and walked among them. There were no grand gestures now. Here he clapped a man on the shoulder, there peered earnestly into a woman's eyes. The country roads? They would be half mud, more streams than roads, from the spring rains. It would take twice as long to reach Lugard that way, three times, maybe longer. Matt almost choked to hear Luca invoke speed, but the man was hardly warming up. He talked of the labor of freeing wagons that bogged down, made his listeners all but see themselves straining to help the teams pull them through mud, nearly hub-deep on the wagon wheels. Not even a country road would get that bad, but he made them see it. At least he made Matt see it. Towns of any size would be few and far between along those back roads, the villages tiny for the most part. Few places to perform, and food for so many hard to come by. He said that while smiling sadly at a little girl of six or so, who was peering up at him from the shelter of her mother's skirts. And you just knew he was envisioning her hungry and crying for food. More than one woman pulled her children close around her. As for Amadisia and Terraban, and yes, Giladan, they would be fine places to perform. Valenluca's grand traveling wonder show and display of marvels would visit those lands and draw immense crowds. One day. To reach any of them now, they must first return to Ebudar, covering the same ground they had crossed these past weeks, passing the same towns where people were unlikely to lay out coin to see again what they had seen so short a time before. A long way, with everyone's purses growing lighter and their bellies tighter by the day. Or they could press on to Lugard. Here his voice began to take on energy. He gestured, but simply. He still moved among them, but stepping more quickly. Lugard was a grand city. Ebudar was a shadow beside Lugard. Lugard truly was one of the great cities, so populous they might perform there all spring and always have new crowds. Matt had never been to Lugard, but he had heard it was half a ruin, with a king who could not afford to keep the streets clean, yet Luca made it sound akin to Camelon. Surely some of these people had seen the place, but they listened with rapt faces as he described palaces that made the Terrasen Palace in Ebudar seem a hovel, talked of the silk-clad nobles by the score who would come to see them perform, or even commission private performances. Surely King Rurdran would want such? Had any of them ever performed before a king before? They would. They would. From Lugard to Camelon, a city that made Lugard look like an imitation of a city. Camelon, one of the largest and wealthiest cities in the world, where they might perform the whole summer to never-ending throngs.
"I should like to see these cities," Tuan said, moving Achaean nearer to Pips. "Will you show them to me, Toy?"
Seleucia kept the dun at Tuan's hip. The woman looked composed enough, but doubtless she was shaken by what she had seen.
"Lugard, maybe. From there I can find a way to send you back to Ebudar."
With a well-guarded merchant's train and as many reliable bodyguards as he could hire. Tuan might be as capable and dangerous as Aginan made out, but two women alone would be seen as easy prey by too many and not just brigands.
Maybe Camelon.
He might need more time than from here to Lugard, after all.
"We shall see what we shall see," Tuan replied cryptically,
then began exchanging finger wriggles with Seleucia. Talking about me behind my back, only doing it right under my nose. He hated it when they did that.
"Luca's as good as a gleeman, Tom, but I don't think he's going to sway them."
Tom snorted derisively and knuckled his long white mustaches.
"He's not bad, I'll grant him that, but he's no gleeman. Still, he's caught them, I'd say. A wager on it, my boy? Say, 1 gold crown?
Matt surprised himself by laughing. He had been sure he would not be able to laugh again until he could rid his head of the image of that peddler sinking into the road. And the horses. He could almost hear them screaming still, loudly enough that it came near to drowning out the dice.
"You want a wager with me? Very well, done."
"I wouldn't play at dice with you," Tom said dryly, "but I know a man turning a crowd's head with words when I see it. I've done as much myself."
Finishing with Camelon, Luca gathered himself with a spark of his usual grandiosity. The man strutted.
"And from there," he announced, "to Tar Valon itself. I will hire ships to carry us all."
Matt did choke at that. Luca would hire ships? Luca, who was tight enough to render mice for tallow?
"Such crowds will come in Tar Valon that we could spend the rest of our lives in that vast city's splendor, where Ogier-built shops seem like palaces, and palaces are beyond description. Rulers seeing Tar Valon for the first time weep that their cities are villages, and their own palaces no more than peasants' huts. The White Tower itself is in Tar Valon, remember? The greatest structure in the world. The Amarlin Seat herself will ask us to perform before her. We have given shelter to three Aes Sedai in need. Who can believe they will do other than speak for us with the Amarlin Seat?"
Matt looked over his shoulder and found the three sisters no longer wandering about the meadow where the village had vanished. Instead, they stood side by side in the road, watching him, perfect images of Aes Sedai serenity. No, they were not watching him, he realized. They were studying Tuon. The three had agreed not to bother her anymore, and being Aes Sedai were bound by that. But how far did an Aes Sedai's word ever go? They found ways around the oath against lying all the time. So Tuon would not get to see Camelin, and perhaps not Lugard. Chances were, there would be Aes Sedai in both cities. What easier for Jolene and the others than to inform those Aes Sedai that Tuon was a Shan Shan High Lady? In all likelihood, Tuon would be on her way to Tar Valon before he could blink. As a guest, of course, to help stop the fighting. No doubt many would say that would be for the good, that he should hand her over himself and tell them who she really was. But he had given his word. He began to calculate how near to Lugard he dared wait before finding her passage back to Abudar. Luca had had a difficult time making Tar Valon sound greater than Camelin after his spiel on that city, and if they ever reached Tar Valon, some might actually be disappointed comparing his mad descriptions. The White Tower 1,000 paces high? Ogier-built palaces the size of small mountains? He claimed there was an Ogier steading actually inside the city. But finally he called for a show of hands in favor of pressing on. Every hand shot up, even the children's hands, and they had no vote. Matt pulled a purse from his coat pocket and handed over an Ebudari crown. "I never enjoyed losing more, Tom." Well, he never enjoyed losing, but in this instance it was better than winning. Tom accepted with a small bow. "I think I'll keep this as a memento," he said, rolling the fat gold coin across the back of his fingers. "To remind me that even the luckiest man in the world can lose." For all the show of hands, there was a shadow of reluctance to cross that patch of road ahead. After Luca got his wagon back onto the road, he sat staring, with Littell clinging to his arm as hard as Amathera ever clung to Julin. Finally, he muttered something that might have been an oath and whipped his team up with the reins. By the time they reached the fatal stretch, they were at a gallop, and Luca kept them there until well beyond where the paving stones had been. It was the same with every wagon. A pause, waiting until the wagon ahead was clear, then a flailing of reins and a hard gallop. Matt himself drew a deep breath before heeling Pips forward. At a walk, not a gallop, but it was hard not to dig his heels in, especially when passing the peddler's hat. Tuon's dark face and Seleucia's pale displayed no more emotion than Aes Sedai's faces did. "I will see Tar Valon one day," Tuon said calmly in the middle of that. "I shall probably make it my capital. I shall have you show me the city, Toy. You have been there." Light. She was a tough little woman, gorgeous but definitely tough as nails. After slowing from his gallop, Luca set the pace at a fast walk, rather than the show's usual amble. The sun slid lower and they passed several roadside meadows sufficiently large to hold the show, but Luca pressed on until their shadows stretched long ahead of them, and the sun was a fat red ball on the horizon. Even then he sat holding the reins and peering at a grassy expanse beside the road.
"It's just a field," he said at last,
too loudly, and turned his team toward it. Matt accompanied Tuon and Seleucia to the purple wagon once the horses had been handed over to Metwin, but there was to be no meal or games of stones with her that night.
"This is a night for prayer," she told him before going in with her maid. "Do you know nothing, Toy?" The dead walking is a sign that Tarmangaiden is near.
He did not take this for one of her superstitions. After all, he had thought something very like that himself. He was not much for praying, yet he offered a small one then and there. Sometimes there was nothing else to do. No one wanted to sleep, so lamps burned late throughout the camp. No one wanted to be alone, either. Matt ate by himself in his tent, with little appetite, and the dice in his head sounding louder than ever. But Tom came to play stones just as he finished, and Noel soon after. Lopin and Nerim popped in every few minutes, bowing and inquiring whether Matt or the others wanted anything, but once they fetched wine and cups, Lopin carried the tall pottery jar and broke the wax seal. Nerim carried the cups on a wooden tray. Matt told them to find Harnan and the other soldiers.
"I don't doubt they're getting drunk, which seems a good notion to me," he said. "That's an order. You tell them I said to share."
Lopin bowed gravely over his round belly.
"I have assisted the file leader now and again by procuring a few items for him, my lord. I expect he will be generous with the brandy. Come along, Nerim. Lord Matt wants us to get drunk, and you are getting drunk with me if I have to sit on you and pour brandy down your throat."
The abstemious Karienin's narrow face grew pinched with disapproval, but he bowed and followed the tyrant out with alacrity. Matt did not think Lopin would need to sit on the man, not tonight. Julin came with Amathera and Ulver, so games of snakes and foxes, played sprawled on the groundcloth, were added to stones played at the small table. Amathera proved an adequate player at stones, unsurprising given that she had been a ruler once, but her mouth became even more pouty when she and Ulver lost at snakes and foxes, although nobody ever won that game. Then again, Matt suspected she had not been a very good ruler. Whoever was not playing sat on the cot. Matt watched the games when it was his turn there, as did Julin, if Amathera was playing. He seldom took his eyes from her, except when it was his turn at a game. Noel nattered on with his stories, but then he spun those tales even while playing, and talking seemed to have no effect on his skill at stones, and Tom sat reading the letter Matt had brought him what seemed a very long time ago. The page was heavily creased from being carried in Tom's coat pocket, and much smudged from being read and reread. He had said it was from a dead woman. It was a surprise when Doman and Aginan ducked through the entry flaps. They had not precisely been avoiding Matt since he moved out of the green wagon, but neither had they gone out of their way to seek him out. Like everyone else, they were in better clothes than they had worn for disguises in the beginning. Aginan's divided skirts and high-collared coat, both of blue wool and embroidered in a yellow near to gold on the hem and cuffs, had something of a uniform about them, while Doman, in a well-cut brown coat and baggy trousers stuffed into turned-down boots just below his knees, looked every inch the prosperous, if not exactly wealthy, Ilioner merchant. As soon as Aginan entered, Amathera, who was on the groundcloth with Ulver, curled herself into a ball on her knees. Julin sighed and got up from the stool across the table from Matt, but Aginan reached the other woman first.
"There's no need for that, with me or anyone else," she drawled, bending to take Amathera by the shoulders and draw her to her feet.
Amathera rose slowly, hesitantly, and kept her eyes down until Aginan put a hand beneath her chin and raised her head gently.
"You look me in the eyes. You look everyone in the eyes."
The Terrabonner woman touched her tongue to her lips nervously, but she did keep looking straight at Aginan's face when the hand was removed from her chin. On the other hand, her eyes were very wide.
"This is a change," Julin said suspiciously, and with a touch of anger.
He stood stiff as a statue carved from dark wood. He disliked any Seanchan for what they had done to Amathera.
"You've called me a thief for freeing her."
There was more than a touch of anger in that. He hated thieves, and smugglers, which Doman was.
"All things change, given time,"
Doman said jovially, smiling to head off more heated words.
"Why, you do be looking at an honest man, Master Thief-Catcher. Lylwyn did make me promise to give up smuggling before she would agree to marry me. Fortune prick me, who did ever hear of a woman refusing to marry a man unless he did give up a lucrative trade?"
He laughed as though that were the funniest joke in the world. Aginan fisted him in the ribs, hard enough to change his laughter to a grunt.
Married to her, his ribs must be a mass of bruises. "I expect you to keep that promise, Bale. I am changing, and so must you.
Eyeing Amathera briefly, perhaps to make sure she was still obeying, Aginin was big on others doing as she told them. She stuck out a hand toward Julin.
I am changing, Master Sandar. Will you?
Julin hesitated, then clasped her hand.
I'll make a try at it.
He sounded doubtful.
An honest try is all I ask.
Frowning around the tent, she shook her head.
I've seen Orlop decks less crowded than this. We have some decent wine in our wagon, Master Sandar. Will you and your lady join us in a cup or two?
Again, Julin hesitated.
He has this game all but won, he said finally. No point in playing it out.
Clapping his conical red hat on his head, he adjusted his dark, flaring Tyran coat unnecessarily and offered his arm to Amathera formally. She clasped it tightly, and though her eyes were still on Aginan's face, she trembled visibly.
I expect Ulver will want to stay here and play his game, but my lady and I will be pleased to share wine with you and your husband, Mistress Shipless.
There was a hint of challenge in his gaze. It was clear that to him, Aginan had further to go to prove she no longer saw Amathera as stolen property. Aginan nodded as if she understood perfectly.
The light shine on you tonight, and for as many days and nights as we have remaining, she said by way of farewell to those staying.
Cheerful of her. No sooner had the four departed than thunder boomed overhead. Another loud peal and rain began pattering on the tent roof, quickly growing to a downpour that drummed the green-striped canvas. Unless Julin and the others had run, they would do their drinking wet. Noel settled on the other side of the red cloth from Ulver and took up Amathera's part of the game, rolling the dice for the snakes and the foxes. The black discs that now represented Ulver and him were nearly to the edge of the web-marked cloth, but it was evident to any eye that they would not make it. To any eye but Ulver's, at least. He groaned loudly when a pale disc, inked with a wavy line, a snake, touched his piece, and again when a disc marked with a triangle touched Noel's. Noel took up the tale he had left off when Aginan and Doman appeared, as well as a story of some supposed voyage on a seafolk raker.
"Atha and Mier women are the most graceful in the world," he said,
moving the black discs back to the circle in the center of the board.
"Even more so than Damani, and you know that's saying something. And when they're out of sight of land..."
He cut off abruptly and cleared his throat, eyeing Ulver, who was stacking the snakes and foxes on the board's corners.
"What do they do then?" Ulver asked.
"Why..."
Noel rubbed his nose with a gnarled finger.
"Why, they scramble about the rigging so nimbly, you'd think they had hands where their feet should be. That's what they do."
Ulver oohed, and Noel gave a soft sigh of relief. Matt began removing the black and white stones from the board on the table, placing them in two carved wooden boxes. The dice in his head bounced and rattled, even when the thunder was loudest.
"Another game, Tom?"
The white-haired man looked up from his letter.
"I think not, Matt. My mind's in a maze tonight."
"If you don't mind my asking, Tom, why do you read that letter the way you do? I mean, sometimes your face looks like you're trying to puzzle out what it means."
Ulver yelped with glee at a good toss of the dice.
"That's because I am, in a way. Here."
He held out the letter, but Matt shook his head.
"It's no business of mine, Tom. It's your letter, and I'm no good with puzzles."
"Oh, it's your business, too. Moraine wrote it just before... Well, anyway, she wrote it."
Matt stared at him for a long moment before taking the creased page, and when his eyes fell on the smudged ink, he blinked. Small, precise writing covered the sheet, but it began, "My dearest Tom." Who would have thought Moraine, of all people, would address old Tom Marilyn so?
"Tom, this is personal. I don't think I should..."
"Read," Tom cut in. "You'll see."
Matt drew a deep breath. A letter from a dead-eye Sedai that was a puzzle and concerned him in some way? Suddenly he wanted nothing less than to read the thing. But he began anyway. It was near enough to make his hair stand on end. My dearest Tom, there are many words I would like to write to you, words from my heart, but I have put this off because I knew that I must, and now there is little time. There are many things I cannot tell you lest I bring disaster, but what I can, I will. Heed carefully what I say. In a short while, I will go down to the docks, and there I will confront Lanfear. How can I know that? That secret belongs to others. Suffice it that I know, and let that foreknowledge stand as proof for the rest of what I say. When you receive this, you will be told that I am dead. All will believe that. I am not dead, and it may be that I shall live to my appointed years. It also may be that you and Matt Cawthon and another, a man I do not know, will try to rescue me. May, I say, because it may be that you will not or cannot, or because Matt may refuse. He does not hold me in the affection you seem to, and he has his reasons which he no doubt thinks are good. If you try, it must be only you and Matt and one other. More will mean death for all. Fewer will mean death for all. Even if you come only with Matt and one other, death also may come. I have seen you try and die, one or two or all three. I have seen myself die in the attempt. I have seen all of us live and die as captives. Should you decide to make the attempt anyway, young Matt knows the way to find me. Yet you must not show him this letter until he asks about it. That is of the utmost importance. He must know nothing that is in this letter until he asks. Events must play out in certain ways, whatever the costs. If you see Lan again, tell him that all of this is for the best. His destiny follows a different path from mine. I wish him all happiness with Nynaeve. A final point. Remember what you know about the game of snakes and foxes. Remember and heed. It is time, and I must do what must be done. May the light illumine you and give you joy, my dearest Tom, whether or not we ever see one another again. Moraine. Thunder boomed as he finished. Fitting that. Shaking his head, he handed the letter back. Tom, he said gently, Lan's bond to her was broken. It takes death to do that. He said she was dead.
And her letter says everyone would believe that. She knew, Matt. She knew it all in advance.
That's as may be, but Moraine and Lanfear went into that door-framed Tirongreal, and it melted. The thing was redstone, or looked to be stone, Tom, yet it melted like wax. I saw it. She went to wherever the Aelfin are, and even if she is alive, there's no way for us to get there anymore. The Tower of Genji, Ulver piped up, and all three adults turned their heads to stare at him. Birgitta told me, he said defensively. The Tower of Genji is the way to the lands of the Aelfin and the Eelfin. He made the gesture that began a game of snakes and foxes, a triangle drawn in the air, and then a wavy line through it. She knows even more stories than you, Master Charon.
That wouldn't be Birgitta's silver bow, would it?
Noel said wryly. The boy gave him a level look. I'm not an infant, Master Charon. But she is very good with a bow, so maybe she is. Birgitta born again, I mean. I don't think there's any chance of that, Matt said. I've talked with her too, you know, and the last thing she wants is to be any kind of hero. He kept his promises, and Birgitta's secrets were safe with him. In any case, knowing about this tower doesn't help much unless she told you where it is. Ulver shook his head sadly, and Matt bent to ruffle his hair. Not your fault, boy. Without you, we wouldn't even know it exists. That did not seem to help much. Ulver stared at the red cloth game board dejectedly.
The Tower of Genji,
Noel said, sitting up cross-legged and tugging his coat straight.
Not many know that tale anymore. Jane always said he'd go looking for it one day. Somewhere along the Shadow Coast, he said.
That's still a lot of ground to search. Matt fitted the lid on one of the boxes. It could take years. years they did not have if Tuon was right, and he was sure that she was. Tom shook his head.
She says you know, Matt. Matt knows the way to find me. I doubt very much she'd have written that on a whim.
Well, I can't help what she says, now can I? I never heard of any Tower of Genji until tonight.
A pity,
Noel sighed.
I'd have liked to have seen it, something Jane Bloody Farstrider never did. You might as well give over,
he added when Tom opened his mouth.
He wouldn't forget seeing it, and even if he never heard the name, he'd have to think of it when he heard of a strange tower that lets people into other lands. The thing gleams like burnished steel, I'm told. 200 feet high and 40 thick, and there's not an opening to be found in it. Who could forget seeing that?
Matt went very still. His black scarf felt too tight against his hanging scar. The scar itself suddenly felt fresh and hot. It was hard for him to draw breath.
If there's no opening, how do we get in? Tom wanted to know.
Noel shrugged, but Ulver spoke up once more.
Brigida says you make the sign on the side of it anywhere with a bronze knife.
He made the sign that started the game.
She says it has to be a bronze knife. Make the sign, and a door opens.
What else did she tell you about?
Tom began, then cut off with a frown.
What ails you, Matt? You look about to sick up.
What ailed him was his memory and not the other men's memories for once. Those had been stuffed into him to fill holes in his own memories, which they did and more, or so it seemed. He certainly remembered many more days than he had lived. But whole stretches of his own life were lost to him, and others were like moth-riddled blankets or shadowy and dim. He had only spotty memories of fleeing Shadowlogoth, and very vague recollections of escaping on Doman's river ship. But one thing seen on that voyage stood out. A tower shining like burnished steel. Sick up. His stomach wanted to empty itself.
I think I know where that tower is, Tom. Rather, Doman knows. But I can't go with you. The Eelfin will know I'm coming. Maybe the Eelfin, too. Burn me, they might already know about this letter because I read it. They might know every word we've said. You can't trust them. They'll take advantage if they can, and if they know you're coming, they'll be planning to do just that. They'll skin you and make harnesses for themselves from your hide.
His memories of them were all his own, but they were more than enough to support the judgment. They stared at him as if he were mad, even Ulver. There was nothing for it but to tell them about his encounters with the Eelfin and the Eelfin, as much as was needful, at least. Not about his answers from the Eelfin, certainly, or his two gifts from the Eelfin. But the other men's memories were necessary to explain what he had reasoned out about the Eelfin and Eelfin, having links to him now. And the pale leather harnesses the Eelfin wore? Those seemed important. And how they had tried to kill him, that was very important. He had said he wanted to leave, and failed to say alive, so they took him outside and hanged him. He even removed the scarf to show his scar for extra weight, and he seldom let anybody see that. The three of them listened in silence, Tom and Noel intently, Ulver's mouth slowly dropping open in wonder. The rain beating on the tent roof was the only sound aside from his voice.
That all has to stay inside this tent, he finished. Aes Sedai have enough reasons already to want to put their hands on me. If they find out about those memories, I'll never be free of them.
Would he ever be entirely free of them? He was beginning to think not, yet there was no reason to give them fresh reasons to meddle in his life.
Are you any relation to Jane?
Noel raised his hands in a placating gesture.
Peace, man, I believe you. It's just that tops anything I ever did. Anything Jane ever did, too. Would you mind if I made the third? I can be handy in tight spots, you know.
Burn me, did everything I say pass in one ear and out the other? They'll know I'm coming. They may already know everything.
And it doesn't matter, Tom put in. Not to me. I'll go by myself if necessary. But if I read this correctly,
he began folding the letter up almost tenderly,
the only hope of success
as if you are one of the three." He sat there on the cot, silent now, looking Matt in the eye. Matt wanted to look away and could not. Bloody Aes Sedai. The woman almost certainly was dead, and yet she still tried coercing him into being a hero. Well, heroes got patted on the head and pushed out of the way until the next time a hero was needed, if they survived being a hero in the first place. Very often heroes did not. He had never really trusted Moiraine, or liked her either. Only fools trusted Aes Sedai. But then, if not for her, he would be back in the Two Rivers, mucking out the barn and tending his Da's cows. Or he would be dead. And there old Tom sat, saying nothing, just staring at him. That was the rub. He liked Tom. Oh, blood and bloody ashes. "Burn me for a fool," he muttered. "I'll go." Thunder crashed deafeningly right atop a flash of lightning so bright it shone through the tent canvas. When the rumbling booms faded, there was dead silence in his head. The last set of dice had stopped. He could have wept. Chapter 11. A Hell in Matarin. Despite the late hours kept by everyone that night, the show made a very early start the next morning. Grainy-eyed and groggy, Matt trudged out of his tent while the sky was still dark to find men and women with lanterns trotting to get ready when they were not running, and nearly everyone shouting for somebody or other to move faster. Many had the unsteady step of people who had not slept. Everyone seemed to feel that the farther they could get from where that village had vanished in front of their eyes, the better. Luca's great gaudy wagon took to the road before the sun had cleared the horizon, and once again he set a goodly pace. Two merchants' trains of 20 or so wagons each passed them, heading south, and a slow caravan of tinkers, but nothing going the other way. The farther, the better. Matt rode with Tuon, and Seleucia made no attempt to put the dun between them, yet there was no conversation, however much he tried to start one. Save for an occasional unreadable glance when he made a sally or told a joke, Tuon rode looking straight ahead, the cowl of her blue cloak hiding her face. Even juggling failed to catch her attention. There was something broody about her silence, and it worried him. When a woman went silent on you, there usually was trouble in the offing. When she brooded, you could forget about usually. He doubted it was the village of the dead that had her fretting. She was too tough for that. No, there was trouble ahead. Little more than an hour after they set out, a farm on rolling ground hove into sight, with dozens of black-faced goats cropping grass in a wide pasture and a large olive grove. Boys weeding among the rows of dark-leaved olive trees dropped their hoes and rushed down to the stone fences to watch the show pass, shouting with excitement to know who they were and where they were going and where coming from. Men and women came out of the sprawling tile-roofed farmhouse and two big thatch-roofed barns, shading their eyes to watch. Matt was relieved to see it. The dead paid no mind to the living. As the show rolled onward, farms and olive groves grew thicker on the ground until they ran side by side, pushing the forest back a mile or more on either side of the road. And well short of mid-morning, they reached a prosperous town somewhat larger than Jurador. A merchant's long train of canvas-topped wagons was turning in at the main gates, where half a dozen men in polished conical helmets and leather coats sewn with steel discs stood guard with halberds. More men, cradling crossbows, kept watch atop the two gate towers. But if the lord of Matarin, one Nathan Sarmain Vendare, expected trouble, the guards were the only sign of it. Farms and olive groves reached right to the stone walls of Matarin, an unsound practice, and right costly should the town ever need to be defended. Luca had to bargain with the farmer for the right to set up the show in an unused pasture and came back muttering that he had just bought the scoundrel a new flock of goats, or maybe two. But the canvas wall was soon rising, with Luca chivying everyone for speed. They were to perform today and leave early in the morning. Very early. Nobody complained or much said an unneeded word. The further, the better.
"And tell no one what you saw," Luca cautioned more than once. "We saw nothing out of the ordinary. We wouldn't want to frighten the patrons away."
People looked at him as if he were insane.
No one wanted to think of that melting village or the peddler, much less speak of them. Matt was sitting in his tent, in his shirt sleeves, waiting for Tom and Julian to return from their trip into the town to learn whether there was a Seanchan presence. He was idly tossing a set of dice on his small table. After an early run of mostly high numbers, five single pips stared up at him 10 times in a row. Most men thought the Dark One's eyes an unlucky toss. Seleucia pulled back the entry flap and strode in. Despite her plain brown divided skirts and white blouse, she managed to seem a queen entering a stable. A filthy stable, by the expression on her face, the Lopin and Nerim could have satisfied his mother when it came to cleaning.
"She wants you," she drawled peremptorily, touching her flowered scarf to make sure her short yellow hair was covered. "Come."
"What's she want with me, then?" he said, and leaned his elbows on the table. He even stretched out his legs and crossed his ankles. Once you let a woman think you would jump whenever she called, you never got out from under again.
"She'll tell you. You're wasting time, Toy. She won't be pleased."
"If Precious expects me to come running when she crooks a finger, she better learn to like being displeased." Grimacing, if her mistress tolerated the name, Seleucia took it for a personal affront, she folded her arms beneath that impressive bosom. It was clear as good glass that she intended to wait there until he went with her, and he was of a mind to make it a long wait. He tossed the dice, the Dark One's eyes, expecting him to jump when Tuan said toad. Ha! Another toss, spinning across the table, one die nearly going over the edge. The Dark One's eyes. Still, he had nothing else to do at the moment. Even so, he took his time donning his coat, a good bronze-colored silk. By the time he picked up his hat, he could hear her foot tapping impatiently. "Well, what are you waiting for?" he asked. She hissed at him. She held the entry flap open, but she purely hissed like a cat. Setala and Tuan were sitting on one of the beds, talking, when he entered the purple wagon, but they cut off the instant he stepped through the door and gave him brief but appraising looks, which told him the subject of their talk had been Matt Cawthon. It made his hackles rise. Plainly, whatever Tuan wanted was something they thought he would disapprove of. And just as plainly, she meant to have it anyway. The table was snug against the ceiling, and Seleucia brushed past him to take a place behind Tuan as the tiny woman sat down on the stool, her face stern and those beautiful big eyes steady. "Hang all the prisoners immediately."
"I wish to visit the common room of an inn," she announced. "Or a tavern. I have never seen the inside of either. You will take me to one in this town, Toy."
He let himself breathe again. "That's easy enough. Just as soon as Tom or Julian lets me know it's safe."
"It must be a low place. What is called a hell."
His mouth fell open.
Low? Hells were the lowest of the low. Dirty and dimly lit, where the ale and wine were cheap and still not worth half what you paid, the food was worse, and any woman who sat on your lap was trying to pick your pocket or cut your purse or else had two men waiting upstairs to crack you over the head as soon as you walked into her room. At any hour of the day or night, you would find dice rolling in a dozen games, sometimes for surprising stakes given the surroundings. Not gold, only a stone fool displayed gold in a hell, but silver often crossed the tables. Few of the gamblers would have come by their coin by any means even halfway honest, and those few would be as hard-eyed as the headcrackers and knifemen who preyed on drunks in the night. Hells always had two or three strong arms with cudgels about to break up fights, and most days they worked hard for their pay. They usually stopped the patrons from killing one another, but when they failed, the corpse was dragged out the back and left in an alley somewhere or on a rubbish heap. And while they were dragging, the drinking never slowed or the gambling either. That was a hell. How had she even heard of such places?
"Did you plant this fool notion in her head?" he demanded of Setala.
"Why, what in the light makes you think that?" she replied, going all wide-eyed the way women did when pretending to be innocent,
or when they wanted you to think they were pretending, just to confuse you. He could not see why they bothered. Women confused him all the time without trying.
"It's out of the question, Precious.
I walk into a hell with a woman like you, and I'll be in 6 knife fights inside the hour, if I survive that long.
Tuan gave a pleased smile. Just a flicker, but definitely pleased.
Do you really think so?
I know so for a fact. Which produced another brief smile of delight. Delight! The bloody woman wanted to see him in a knife fight.
Even so, Toy, you promised.
They were arguing over whether he had made a promise. While he was calmly presenting the logic that saying something was easy was no promise, Tuan just stubbornly insisted he had promised, while Sitala took up her embroidery hoop and Seleucia watched him with the amused air of someone watching a man try to defend the indefensible. And he did not shout, no matter what Tuan said, when a knock came at the door. Tuan paused.
You see, Toy, she said after a moment, that is how it is done. You knock and then wait.
She made a simple gesture over one shoulder at her maid.
You may enter the presence, Seleucia called, drawing herself up regally.
She probably expected whoever came in to prostrate themselves. It was Tom, in a dark blue coat and dark gray cloak, that would make him unremarked in any common room or tavern, neither well-to-do nor poor. A man who could afford to pay for his own drink while listening to the gossip, or buy another man a cup of wine to pay for hearing his news and the latest rumors. He did not prostrate himself, but he did make an elegant bow despite his bad right leg.
My lady,
he murmured to Tuan before turning his attention to Matt.
Harnan said he saw you strolling this way. I trust I'm not interrupting. I heard voices.
Matt scowled. He had not been shouting.
You're not interrupting. What did you find out?
That there may be Shonchan in the town from time to time. No soldiers, but it seems they're building 2 farm villages a few miles to the north of the road and 3 more a few miles south. The villagers come to town to buy things now and then.
Matt managed to keep from smiling as he spoke over his shoulder. He even got a smattering of regret into his voice.
I'm afraid there's no jaunt into Matarin for you, precious. Too dangerous.
Tuan folded her arms, emphasizing her bosom.
There were more curves to her than he had once thought. Not like Seleucia, certainly, but nice curves.
Farmer's Toy, she drawled dismissively. No farmer has ever seen my face. You promised me a tavern or a common room, and you won't escape on this puny excuse.
A common room should present no difficulties, Tom said. It's a pair of scissors or a new pot these farmers are after, not drink. They make their own ale, it seems, and don't much like the local brew.
Thank you, Tom, Matt said through gritted teeth. She wants to see a hell.
The white-haired man gave a wheezing cough and knuckled his mustaches vigorously.
A hell? He muttered.
A hell. Do you know a hell in this town where I might take her without starting a riot?
He intended the question for sarcasm, but Tom surprised him by nodding.
I might just know a place at that, the man said slowly. The White Ring. I intend to go there anyway, to see what news I can pick up.
Matt blinked. However unremarked Tom might be elsewhere, he would be looked at askance in a hell wearing that coat. More than askance. The usual garb there was coarse, dirty wool and stained linen. Besides, asking questions in a hell was a good way to have a knife planted in your back. But maybe Tom meant that this white ring was not a hell at all. Tuan might not know the difference if the place were only a little rougher than the usual.
Should I get Harnan and the others? He asked, testing.
Oh, I think you and I should be protection enough for the lady, Tom said, with what might have been the ghost of a smile,
and knots loosened in Matt's shoulders.
He still cautioned the 2 women.
There was no question of Seleucia staying behind, of course. Mistress Annan refused Tuan's invitation to accompany them, saying she had already seen as many hells as she had any wish to, about keeping their hoods well up.
Tuan might believe no farmer had ever seen her face, but if a cat could gaze on a king, as the old saying said, then a farmer might have gazed on Tuan some time or other, and it would be just their luck to have 1 or 2 of them turn up in Matarin. Being Tavirin usually seemed to twist the pattern for the worst in his experience.
toy,
Tuan said gently as Seleucia settled the blue cloak on her slim shoulders.
I have met many farmers while visiting the country, but they very properly kept their eyes on the ground even if I allowed them to stand. Believe me, they never saw my face.
Oh. He went to fetch his own cloak and his hat. White clouds nearly obscured the sun, still short of its midday peak, and it was a brisk day for spring, with a strong breeze to boot. People from the town crowded the main street of the show, men in rough woolens or sober coats of finer stuff with just a touch of embroidery on the cuffs, women, many wearing lace caps and somber collared dresses beneath long white aprons or dark high-necked dresses with embroidery curling across the bosom, children darting everywhere, escaping their parents and being chased down, all of them oohing and aahing at Miora's leopards or Latel's bears, at the jugglers or Balat and Abar eating fire, the lean brothers moving in unison. Not pausing for so much as a glimpse of the female acrobats, Matt threaded through the throng with Tuan on his arm, which he assured by placing her hand on his left wrist. She hesitated a moment, then nodded slightly, a queen giving assent to a peasant. Tom had offered his arm to Seleucia, but she stayed at her mistress's left shoulder. At least she did not try to crowd between. Luca, in scarlet coat and cloak, was beneath the big banner at the entrance, watching coins clink into the glass pitcher, clink again as they were dropped into the strongbox. He wore a smile on his face. The line waiting to get in stretched near 100 paces along the canvas wall, and more people were trickling out of the town, heading toward the show.
"I could take in a fine bit here over 2 or 3 days," he told Matt. "After all, this place is solid, and we're far enough from—"
His smile flickered out like a snuffed candle.
"You think we're far enough, don't you?"
Matt sighed. Gold would defeat fear every time in Valenluca. He could not hold his cloak closed with Tuam on his arm, so it flared behind him in the stiff breeze, yet that was to the good. The gate guards, slouching in a ragged line, eyed them curiously, and one made a sketchy bow. Silk and lace had that effect, with country armsmen, at least. And that was what these men were, no matter how brightly they had burnished their helmets and coin-armor coats. Most leaned on their halberds like farmers leaning on shovels. But Tom stopped, and Matt was forced to halt, too, a few paces into the town. After all, he had no idea where the White Ring lay.
"A heavy guard, Captain,"
Tom said, worry touching his voice.
"Are there brigands in the area?"
"No outlaws around here," a grizzled guard said gruffly.
A puckered white scar slanting across his square face combined with a squint to give him a villainous appearance. He was not one of the leaners, and he held his halberd as if he might know how to use it.
"The Shanshan cleaned out the few we hadn't caught. Move along now, old fellow. You're blocking the way."
There was not a wagon or cart in sight, and the few people leaving the town afoot had plenty of room. The gate arch was wide enough for 2 wagons abreast, though it might be a squeeze.
"The Shanshan said we didn't set enough guards,"
a stocky fellow about Matt's age put in cheerfully.
"And Lord Nathan listens close when the Shanshan talk."
The grizzled man clouted him with a gauntleted hand on the back of his helmet hard enough to stagger him.
"You watch your mouth with people from off, Kyler," the older man growled. "Else you'll be back behind a plow before you can blink. My lord," he added to Matt, raising his voice, "you want to call your servant before he gets himself in trouble?"
"My apologies, Captain,"
Tom said humbly, ducking his white head, the very image of a chastened serving man.
"No offense meant. My apologies."
"He would have thumped you, too, if I hadn't been there," Matt told him when he caught up.
Tom was limping noticeably. He must have been tired for it to show that much.
"He almost did anyway. And what did you learn that was worth risking that?"
"I wouldn't have asked without you in that coat,"
Tom chuckled as they walked deeper into the town.
"The first lesson is what questions to ask. The second, and just as important, is when and how to ask. I learned there aren't any brigands, which is always good to know, though I've heard of very few bands big enough to attack something as large as the show. I learned Nathan is under the Shanshan thumb.
Either he's obeying a command with those extra guards, or he takes their suggestions as commands. And most important, I learned that Nathan's armsmen don't resent the Shon Chan.
Matt quirked an eyebrow at him.
They didn't spit when they said the name, Matt. They didn't grimace or growl. They won't fight the Shon Chan, not unless Nathan tells them to, and he won't.
Tom exhaled heavily.
It's very strange. I've found the same everywhere, from Ebu Dar to here. These outlanders come, take charge, impose their laws, snatch up women who can channel, and if the nobles resent them, very few among the common people seem to. Unless they've had wife or relation collared, anyway. Very strange. And it bodes ill for getting them out again. But then Altara is Altara. I'll wager they're finding a colder reception in Almadicia and Terabon. He shook his head. We had best hope they are, else...
He did not say what else, but it was easy to imagine. Matt glanced at Tuon.
How did she feel hearing Tom talk about her people so?
She said nothing, only walked at his side, peering curiously at everything from the shelter of her cowl. Tile-roofed buildings, 3 and 4 stories tall, most of brick, lined the wide stone-paved main street of Matarin. Shops and inns with signs that swung in the stiff breeze crowded in beside stables and rich people's homes with large lamps above the arched doorways, and humbler structures that housed poorer folk by the laundry hanging from nearly every window. Horse carts and hand barrows, laden with bales or crates or barrels, slowly made their way through a moderately thick throng, men and women with brisk strides, full of that storied southern industry, children dashing about in games of catch. Tuon studied it all with equal interest. A fellow pushing a wheeled grindstone and crying that he sharpened scissors or knives till they could cut wishes caught her attention as much as a lean, hard-faced woman in leather trousers with 2 swords strapped to her back. Doubtless a merchant's guard or perhaps a hunter for the horn, but a rarity either way. A buxom Damani in a clinging red dress that fell just short of transparent, with a pair of bulky bodyguards and scale-armor jerkins at her back, cut neither more nor less study, than a lanky one-eyed fellow in frayed wool hawking pins, needles, and ribbons from a tray. He had not noticed this sort of curiosity from her in Jurador, but she had been intent on finding silk in Jurador. Here she seemed to be trying to memorize all she saw. Tom soon led them off into a maze of twisting streets, most of which deserved the name only because they were paved with rough stone blocks the size of a man's 2 fists. Buildings as big as those on the main street, some housing shops on the ground floor, loomed over them, almost shutting out the sky. Many of those ways were too narrow for horse carts. In some, Matt would not have had to extend his arms fully to touch the walls on either side. And more than once he had to press Tuon against the front of a building to let a heavy-loaded hand-barrow rumble past over the uneven paving stones, the barrow man calling apologies for the inconvenience without slowing. Porters trudged through that cramped warren too, men walking bent nearly parallel to the ground, each with a bale or crate on his back held level by a padded leather roll strapped to his hips. Just the sight of them made Matt's own back ache. They reminded him how much he hated work. He was on the point of asking Tom how far they had to go, Matarin was not that big a town, when they reached the White Ring, on one of those winding streets where his arms could more than compass the width of the pavement, a brick building of 3 floors across from a cutler's shop. The painted sign hanging over the inn's red door, a frilly white circle of lace, made the knots return to his shoulders. Ring, it might be called, but that was a woman's garter if he ever had seen one. It might not be a hell, but inns with signs like that usually were rowdy enough in their own right. He eased the knives up his coat sleeves and those in his boot tops as well, felt the blades under his coat, shrugged just to get the feel of the one hanging behind his neck. Though if it went that far... Tuon nodded approvingly. The bloody woman was dying to see him get into a knife fight. Seleucia had the sense to frown.
Ah, yes, Tom said, a wise precaution.
And he checked his own knives, tightening those knots in Matt's shoulders a little more. Tom carried almost as many blades as he did, up his sleeves, beneath his coat. Seleucia writhed her fingers at Tuon, and suddenly they were in a silent argument, fingers flashing. Of course, it could not be that. Tuon bloody well owned Seleucia, the same as owning a dog, and you did not argue with your dog. But an argument it seemed. Both women with their jaws set stubbornly. Finally, Seleucia folded her hands and bowed her head in acquiescence. A reluctant submission.
"It will be well," Tuon told her in a jollying tone. "You will see, it will be well."
Matt wished he was sure of that. Taking a deep breath, he extended his wrist for her hand again and followed Tom. The spacious, wood-paneled common room of the White Ring held better than 24 men and women, nearly half obvious outlanders, at square tables beneath a thick-beamed ceiling. All neatly dressed in finely woven wool, with little by way of ornamentation, most were talking quietly over their wine in pairs, cloaks draped over their low-backed chairs, though three men and a woman with long beaded braids were tossing bright red dice from a wine cup at one table. Pleasant smells drifted from the kitchen, including meat roasting, goat most likely. Beside the wide stone fireplace, where a parsimonious fire burned, and a polished brass barrel clock sat on the mantel, a saucy-eyed young woman who rivaled Seleucia, and with her blouse unlaced nearly to her waist to prove it, swayed her hips and sang, accompanied by a hammered dulcimer and a flute, a song about a woman juggling all of her lovers. She sang in a suitably bawdy voice. None of the patrons appeared to be listening. "As I walked out one fine spring day, I met young Jack, who was pitching hay. His hair so fair and his eyes were too. Well, I gave him a kiss. Oh, what could I do? We snuggled and we tickled while the sun rose high, and I won't say how often he made me sigh." Lowering her hood, Tuon stopped just inside the door and frowned around the room. "Are you certain this is a hell, Master Marilyn?" she asked. In a low voice, thank the light. Some places a question of that sort could get you thrown out, and roughly, silk coat or no. In others, the price is just doubled.
"I assure you, you won't find a bigger collection of thieves and rascals anywhere in Matarin at this hour," Tom murmured, stroking his mustaches.
"Now Jack gets an hour when the sky is clear, and Willie gets an hour when my father's not near. It's the hayloft with Morrel, for he shows no fear, and Kylan comes at midday. He's oh so bold. Lord Brelan gets an evening when the night is cold. Master Andrew gets a morning, but he's very old. Oh, what is a poor girl to do? My loves are so many and the hours so few."
Tuon looked doubtful, but with Seleucia at her shoulder, she walked over to stand in front of the singer, who faltered a moment at Tuon's intense scrutiny before catching the song up again. She sang over the top of Tuon's head, plainly attempting to ignore her. It seemed that with every other verse, the woman in the song added a new lover to her list. The male musician, playing the dulcimer, smiled at Seleucia and got a frosty stare back. The two women got other looks as well, the one so small and with very short black hair, the other rivaling the singer, and with her head wrapped in a scarf, but no more than glances. The patrons were intent on their own business.
"It isn't a hell," Matt said softly, "but what is it? Why would so many people be here in the middle of the day?"
It was mornings and evenings when common rooms filled up like this.
"The locals are selling olive oil, lacquerware, or lace," Tom replied just as quietly, "and the outlanders are buying. It seems local custom is to begin with a few hours of drink and conversation. And if you have no head for it," he added dryly, "you sober up to find you've made much less of a bargain than you thought in your wine." "Like, Tom, she'll never believe this place is a hell. I thought you were taking us somewhere merchant's guards drink or apprentices. At least she might believe that."
"Trust me, Matt, I think you'll find she has lived a very sheltered life in some ways."
"Sheltered?
When her own brothers and sisters tried to kill her?"
"You wouldn't care to wager a crown on it, would you?"
Tom chuckled.
"Always glad to take your coin."
Tuon and Seleucia came gliding back, faces expressionless.
"I expected rougher garb on the patrons," Tuon said quietly, "and perhaps a fight or two. but the song is too salacious for a respectable inn, though she is much too covered to sing it properly, in my opinion. What is that for? She added in tones of suspicion as Matt handed Tom a coin.
Oh, Tom said, slipping the crown into his coat pocket. I thought you might be disappointed that only the more successful blackguards were present. They aren't always so colorful as the poorer sort. But Matt said you'd never notice.
She leveled a look at Matt, who opened his mouth indignantly, and closed it again. What was there to say? He was already in the pickling kettle. No need to stoke the fire. As the innkeeper approached, a round woman with suspiciously black hair beneath a white lace cap, stuffed into a gray dress embroidered in red and green across her more than ample bosom, Tom slipped away with a bow and murmured,
"By your leave, my lord, my lady."
Murmured, but loud enough for Mistress Highland to hear. The innkeeper had a flinty smile, yet she exercised it for a lord and lady, curtsying so deeply that she grunted, straightening back up, and she seemed only a little disappointed that Matt wanted wine and perhaps food, not rooms. Her best wine. Even so, when he paid, he let her see that he had gold in his purse as well as silver. A silk coat was all very well, but gold-wearing rags got better service than copper-wearing silk.
"Ale," Tuan drawled. "I've never tasted ale. Tell me, good mistress, is it likely any of these people will start a fight any time soon?"
Matt nearly swallowed his tongue. Mistress Highland blinked and gave her head a small shake, as if uncertain she really had heard what she thought she had.
"No need to worry, my lady," she said. "It happens time to time if they get too far in their cups. But I'll settle them down hard if it does."
"Not on my account," Tuan told her. "They should have their sport." The innkeeper's smile went crooked and barely held, but she managed another curtsy, then scurried away, clutching Matt's coin and calling,
"Jera, wine for the lord and lady, a pitcher of Caranile, and a mug of ale."
"You mustn't ask questions like that, precious," Matt said quietly as he escorted Tuan and Seleucia to an empty table. Seleucia refused a chair, taking Tuan's cloak and draping it over the chair she held for Tuan, then standing behind it. "It isn't polite. Besides, it lowers your eyes." Thank the light for those talks with the Geenan, whatever name she wanted to go by. Shan Chen would do any fool thing or refuse to do what was sensible to avoid having their eyes lowered. Tuan nodded thoughtfully.
"Your customs are often very peculiar, Toy. You will have to teach me about them. I have learned some, but I must know the customs of the people I will rule in the name of the Empress. May she live forever."
"I'll be glad to teach you what I can," Matt said, unpinning his cloak and letting it fall carelessly over the low back of his chair. "It will be good for you to know our ways, even if you end up ruling a sight less than you expect to." He set his hat on the table. Tuan and Seleucia gasped as one, hands darting for the hat. Tuan's reached it first, and she quickly put it on the chair next to her.
"That is very bad luck, Toy. Never put a hat on a table."
She made one of those odd gestures for warding off evil, folding under the middle two fingers and extending the other two stiffly. Seleucia did the same.
"I'll remember that," he said dryly.
Perhaps too dryly. Tuan gave him a level look, very level.
"I have decided you will not do for a cupbearer, Toy, not until you learn meekness, which I almost despair of teaching you. Perhaps I will make you a running groom instead. You are good with horses. Would you like trotting at my stirrup when I ride? The robes are much the same as for a cupbearer, but I will have yours decorated with ribbons. Pink ribbons."
He managed to maintain a smooth face, but he felt his cheeks growing hot. There was only one way she could know pink ribbons had any special significance to him. Tylin had told her. It had to be. Burn him, women would talk about anything. The arrival of the serving maid with their drink saved him from having to make any response. Jera was a smiling young woman with nearly as many curves as the singer, not so well displayed, yet not really concealed by the white apron she wore tied snugly. Her dark woolen dress
fit quite snugly, too. Not that he gave her more than a glance, of course. He was with his wife-to-be. Anyway, only a complete woolhead looked at a woman while with another. Jera placed a tall pewter wine pitcher and two polished pewter cups on the table, and handed a thick mug of ale to Seleucia, then blinked in confusion when Seleucia transferred the mug to Tuon and took a cup of wine in return. He handed her a silver penny to settle her discomposure, and she gave him a beaming smile with her curtsy before darting off to another call from the innkeeper. It was unlikely she received much in the way of silver.
"You could have smiled back at her, Toy," Tuon said, holding the mug up for a sniff and wrinkling her nose. "She is very pretty. You were so stone-faced, you probably frightened her."
She took a sip, and her eyes widened in surprise.
"This is actually quite good."
Matt sighed and took a long swallow of dark wine that smelled faintly of flowers. In none of his memories, his own or those other men's, could he recall having understood women. Oh, one or two things here and there, but never anywhere near completely. Sipping her ale steadily, he was not about to tell her ale was taken in swallows, not sips. She might get herself drunk deliberately just to experience a hell fully. He was not ready to put anything past her today. Or any day. Taking sips between every sentence, the maddening little woman questioned him on customs. Telling her how to behave in a hell was easy enough. Keep to yourself, ask no questions, and sit with your back to a wall if you could, and near to a door in case of a need to leave suddenly. Better not to go at all, but if you had to. Yet she quickly passed on to courts and palaces, and got few answers there. He could have told her more of customs in the courts of Aharon or Shiota, or a dozen other dead nations, than in those of any nation that still lived. Scraps of how things were done in Camelon and Tyr were all he really knew, and bits from Faldara in Shinar. Well, that in Ebu Dar, but she already knew those ways.
"So you have traveled widely and been in other palaces than the Tarasen," she said finally, and took the last bit of ale in her mug.
He had not finished half his wine yet. He thought Seleucia had not taken above two small swallows of hers.
"But you are not nobly born, it seems. I thought you must not be."
"That I am not," he told her firmly. "Nobles..." He trailed off, clearing his throat. He could hardly tell her nobles were fools with their noses so high in the air they could not see where they were stepping. She was who and what she was, after all. Expressionless, Tuon studied him while pushing her empty mug to one side. Still studying, she flickered the fingers of her left hand over her shoulder, and Seleucia clapped her own hands together loudly. Several of the other patrons looked at them in surprise.
"You called yourself a gambler," Tuon said, "and Master Merlin named you the luckiest man in the world."
Jera came running, and Seleucia handed her the mug.
"Another, quickly," she commanded, though not in an unkindly way.
Still, she had a regal manner to her. Jera dropped a hasty curtsy and scurried off again as though she had been shouted at.
"I have luck sometimes," Matt said cautiously. "Let's see whether you have any today, Toy."
Tuon looked toward the table where the dice were rattling on the tabletop. He could see no harm in it. It was a certainty he would win more than he lost, yet he thought it unlikely one of the merchants would pull a knife, however much his luck was in. He had not noticed anyone carrying one of those long belt knives that everybody wore farther south. Standing, he offered Tuon his arm, and she rested her hand lightly on his wrist. Seleucia left her wine on the table and stayed close to her mistress. Two of the Altaran men, one lean and bald except for a dark fringe, the other round-faced, above three chins, scowled when he asked whether a stranger might join the game, and the third, a graying stocky fellow, with a pendulous lower lip, went stiff as a fence-post. The Terrabonner woman was not so unfriendly.
Of course, why not?" she said, her speech slightly slurred.
Her face was flushed, and the smile she directed at him had a slackness about it. Apparently she was one of those with no head for wine. It seemed the locals wanted to keep her happy because the scowls vanished, though the graying man remained wooden-faced. Matt fetched chairs from a nearby table for himself and Tuon. Seleucia chose to remain standing behind Tuon, which was just as well. Six people crowded the table. Jera arrived to curtsy and proffer a refilled mug to Tuon with both hands and a murmured "Milady," and another serving woman, graying and nearly as stout as Mistress Hyland, replaced the wine pitcher on the gambler's table. Smiling, the bald man filled the Terrabonner's cup to the brim. They wanted her happy and drunk. She drained half the cup and with a laugh wiped her lips delicately with a lace-edged handkerchief. Getting it back up her sleeve required two tries. She would come away with no good bargains this day. Matt watched a little play and soon recognized the game. It used four dice rather than two, but without a doubt it was a version of Piri, Match, a game that had been popular for 1,000 years before Arthur Hawkwing began his rise. Small piles of silver had mixed with a few gold coins lay in front of each of the players, and it was a silver mark that he laid in the middle of the table to buy the dice while the stout man was gathering his winnings from the last toss. He expected no trouble from merchants, but trouble was less likely if they lost silver rather than gold. The lean man matched the wager, and Matt rattled the crimson dice in the pewter cup, then spun them out onto the table. They came to rest showing four fives.
"Is that a winning toss?" Tuon asked.
"Not unless I match it," Matt replied, scooping the dice back into the cup, "without tossing a 14 or the Dark One's eyes first."
The dice clattered in the cup, clattered across the table. Four fives. His luck was in for sure. He slid one silver coin over in front of himself and left the other. Abruptly, the graying fellow scraped back his chair and stood up.
"I've had enough," he muttered, and began fumbling the coins in front of him into his coat pockets.
The other two Altarans stared at him incredulously.
"You're leaving, Vane?" the lean man said. "Now?"
"I said I've had enough, Cameron," the graying man growled, and went stumping out into the street, pursued by Cameron's scowl at his back.
The Terrabonner woman leaned over unsteadily, her beaded braids clicking on the tabletop, to pat the fat man's wrist.
"Just means I'll buy my lacquerware from you, Master Costell," she said fuzzily. "You and Master Cameron."
Costell's triple chins wobbled as he chuckled.
"So it does, Mistress Ulstein. So it does. Doesn't it, Cameron?" "I suppose," the bald man replied grumpily. "I suppose."
He shoved a mark out to match Matt's. Once again, the dice spun across the table. This time, they came up totaling 14.
"Oh,"
Tuon said, sounding disappointed.
"You lost."
"I won, precious. That's a winning toss if it's your first."
He left his original bet in the middle of the table. "Another?" he said with a grin.
His luck was in all right, as strong as it had ever been.
The bright red dice rolled across the table, ricocheted across the table, bounced off the wagered coins sometimes, and toss after toss they came to rest showing 14 white pips. He made 14 every way it could be made. Even at one coin to a wager, the silver in front of him grew to a tidy sum. Half the people in the common room came to stand around the table and watch. He grinned at Tuon, who gave him a slight nod. He had missed this, dice in a common room or tavern, coin on the table, wondering how long his luck would hold, and a pretty woman at his side while he gambled. He wanted to laugh with pleasure.